Yes, please. What's your question there for Dr. Zacharias or Abdul Murray?
Well, Michael, I want to thank you all for coming out tonight and spending time here. My question is, when debating atheists like Stephen Hawking and other people like that, what is the how do you convince someone like him that God exists without using the Bible necessarily?
Well, I was having lunch with Stephen Hawking yesterday. No, I'm just kidding. I'm sure your question is not specific, but we get the idea. I spent 6 months at Ridley Hall in Cambridge and actually heard one or two lectures from him, one a very famous lecture from him at Lady Mitchell Hall in 1990. And he was addressing the issue of are we determined or are we free? And, of course, Hawking is considered, if not the brightest, one of the brightest minds in the world of science today, which is very amazing to me. He can't speak because of Lou Gehrig's disease. He has this computer designed by a Caltech scientist, and either by the cutting into the infrared ray with his eyelid or with a movement of finger, he's able to select letters, texts, and so on. And it's amazing that so it takes him very long to even answer a question. That's why you can ask very difficult questions, and it'll take him about 2 or 3 minutes to compute his answer, and his answer always is very brief. But you know, the interesting thing is, if naturalism was the only worldview reigning, I wonder if Stephen Hawking would have made it this far. A scientist gave him the equipment by which he could communicate, but it was love, compassion, altruism, and generosity that cared for him and brought him through all of those years. So there were philosophical ideas behind it that protected his life. In his brief history of time, the last page, he makes something like this. He said, "Now I have told you what. If I could tell you why, we would have the mind of God." Very interesting that he gave that little caveat, and at that time he was attending one or two churches in the area on the weekend, and somebody told me who knew him that he was on his own spiritual search. But of course in his later book, The Grand Design, he talked about the fact that gravity explains everything, and he made the very irrational and unfortunate statement that philosophy is dead. So much so, theologians did not respond to him. The chairman of the philosophy department at Cambridge responded by saying, "Maybe it's about time the oracular Professor Hawking recognized that he's not kept up with our discipline as much as we have with his," and this kind of hostility developed. But as I told you, down the road was John Polkinghorne, the quantum physicist, who of course knows Stephen Hawking. I don't know what the answer is, how one leads him, but the answer to your specific question, how do you do it without invoking the Bible, is really not that difficult. Because his explanation that gravity is really at the heart of it and explains everything is like me explaining a dictionary because of the alphabet. It doesn't follow. The alphabet exists, but the compilation requires design and specified complexity. It is a rather simplistic explanation to say gravity explains it all. And our colleague from Oxford, John Lennox, responded to Stephen Hawking in one of his books, and I think he called it Stephen Hawking's God or something to that nature, John Lennox, who has a triple doctorate and was professor of mathematics at Green College, Cambridge, Green College, Oxford, and is one of our colleagues on our team. So they've responded. David Berlinsky also, even though he's a skeptic, has responded. I would basically say three very simple things. Number one, however you section physical concrete reality, you always end up with a state of affairs that concrete reality doesn't explain its own existence. That physical concrete reality doesn't explain its own existence. Number two, wherever you see specified complexity and design, you assume a designer. Number three, looking at the history of culture, humanity, and history, you see the very person of Jesus Christ coming with the prophetic scheme and the specifics of it and all the promises contained there, and his transformation in the human heart. So whether you take those three stages, however you cut down physical concrete reality, you end up with a state of affairs that it doesn't explain its own existence. Whenever you see specified complexity or design, you assume a designer. And in the human events and course of history and culture and the human search, you see, especially in the person of Jesus Christ, the evidence of God's existence. But if you take just the first two and leave the third out, it ought to lead you to wherever the evidence actually directs you. And once you accept the existence of something non-physical that is eternal and a designer, you can go into history and the human experience and see how it is that Jesus Christ indeed has changed lives, changed history, changed hearts. And in that three stages, I think you can demonstrate the reality of a personal, moral, first cause who also offers to transform the human heart. That would be my basic response, but people like Stephen, like John Polkinghorne and all in his book, One World, have done a marvelous job of explaining it. Do you have anything to add to that, Abdu?
Just something short. It would be this. The next step, though, is not just to speak to the language that someone else speaks. And if it's science, then we can talk about science. And science points to things. Now, science is a measure of the physical world. But it also leads to implications about what the world is actually like in a non-physical realm, in terms of the moralities that are around us, in terms of the meaning and the purpose for what which we were created. In fact, when you look at someone like Francis Collins, who is himself a Christian, a quite devoted Christian, who is a scientist, in fact, the leader of the Human Genome Project, and now I think the director of the National Institutes of Health, he will tell you that when you look at DNA, for example, you have the universe itself, then you have the specific design of DNA itself, 3.1 billion bits of information, specifically ordered. And we're finding more and more of the information that's actually coding for, or actually has function, the more and more we look at it. You're seeing something. You're not seeing a specific statement that says this is God created, but it is an implication that that which is ordered specifically has an informer. The information has an informer. There's an implication being made there, a leap. Not too far of a leap. In fact, when you look at Stephen Hawking's own words about the way in which the universe itself seems to be designed, that there are certain properties that if they were even infinitesimally off by a hair's breadth, you'd have no life possible in the universe in any way. And to quote, I think it was Frederick Coyle who said, Edwin Hubble, I can't remember which one of the H's, who said that it looks like somebody's been monkeying with the physics. Interesting statement. But there's another aspect to this. Once we speak about these things, then we can start talking about what the Bible actually has to say about these things. Because if the Bible is true, this might get you to theism. But how does it get you to understand if Christian theism actually holds water? Because if the Bible comports with what we find in the natural realm, if the Bible comports with what we find in the moral realm, then you see a correspondence between the two. And I'll tell you this. As someone who was not friendly in any way, shape, or form to the validity of the Bible, I remember specifically grabbing a little green Bible from a Gideon. I still have that little green Bible, going back to my apartment so I could find a contradiction in it that would finally sort of, these two guys who were coming to my door, they were trying to convert me to Christianity. I was going to knock them down finally with an objection, a contradiction they couldn't explain. And in that little green Bible, specific words, I won't go into the detail because time doesn't permit, but specific words from Luke chapter 3, verse 7, suddenly got me thinking about objective truths and whether or not I was being fair with the data. Here's the point. The Bible itself spoke to a skeptic of it. So be careful about our desire to speak with lofty arguments and closed Bibles. We can actually have that Bible. It's not going to be the primary source always, but it can be a source where we can look at it and say, now does what we've explored comport with what this Bible teaches? And if it does, now it's worthy of our belief. Great question. Thank you.
Thank you. Yeah. We have, we're going to take, you know, this is going to be about a 30-minute time. We appreciate the time here, but we want to tackle as many questions as we can. Again, we're going to do some more afterwards. Dr. Zacharias and Mr. Murray will be down front, but a few more questions here, please. Go ahead.
I just wanted to know
why did
God put the tree in the garden to begin with? He ultimately knew what decision Adam and Eve would make. So why even put the tree there to begin with? Because it makes it just seem like we're just a big social experiment.
Let me give a shout out at first. Great question. If you understand, if you look at what the nature of God first, that's what I go to, the nature of God first. And from a Christian perspective, God is a community. There is one God who is one being, but three in his personhoods, Father, Son, Holy Spirit, eternally distinct personhoods who share one nature. Is that easy to grasp? No. Is it comprehensible by finite human beings? No, but it doesn't go against our logic. So God exists in the Christian mindset as a community. He defines what love and relationship is. He eternally exists in a state of relationship. So you, as an effect, he's the cause, but you, as an effect, actually crave, desire, want, covet, and mourn the loss of relationship. It's one of the key things about human existence. And you're the effect. Shouldn't the cause reflect something about that? And in this case, in the Christian worldview, the cause, who is a triune being who exists in relationship, actually explains why you, the effect, want it so badly. Now, how does that relate to your question on the Garden of Eden? God himself is a relational being. And in order to have true relationship, instead of a wind-you-up automaton like the monkeys who clasp like this and the eyes bug out and all these things, where we just wind up and see where we go, he creates the ability for us to have a choice, an actual freedom to choose relationship. Because relationship not chosen is not really relationship at all. But relationship chosen is real. Love actually has an existence then in a real sense because love itself is vulnerable. So he creates this scenario where people can actually choose. The choice is freely given. God's foreknowledge does not necessarily mean he creates the choice that they make, but the possibility for them to make that choice. He does it so that we can have relationship. You see, the God of the Bible does not lack relationship. He never lacks it. He eternally exists in that state. So why create us? He doesn't need us for relationship. Why create you or create me to muck it up? He creates you and creates me not so that he can have relationship. He's already got it within himself in the Godhead. He creates you and creates me so that you can. It is an utterly selfless act in that sense. He utterly and selflessly creates out of an abundance of his love, out of abundance of who he is as a relational being, and that relationship requires choice and a free will that's there. And that tree allows for that. And because of that, you and I, there's a fallen nature to humanity, and that's there as well. But then the redemption comes in, and then we are offered, as Ravi had already said from John 3:16, that God so loved, relational quality, the world, that he gave his only begotten Son, that whosoever shall believe, an act freely given, an act freely chosen, shall not perish but have everlasting life. From the beginning we have relationship, from eternity we have relationship, and in redemption we have relationship. And the tree actually is the beginning of that.
It's a very, very good question, sir. And I think it actually hinges a little bit also on the previous one. You know, the thing about skeptics sometimes when they ask us these questions, and I'm not saying it's you because I don't know the background from which you're coming, is oftentimes I wonder whether they realize we ask these same questions. You know, we struggle with these issues. It's not like we think these are invalid questions. They are very valid questions. But what does the question assume? The question assumes something very critical, that the answer should be coherent, because a coherent worldview is what you're really looking for. You cannot be comfortable with incoherence. And the question that was asked earlier, the whole issue of how does one talk to a Stephen Hawking? The fascinating thing about the talk that Stephen Hawking gave in 1990 at the Lady Mitchell Auditorium, which was packed, on the question of is man determined or is he free, he went through about 25 minutes of all kinds of scientific arguments and so on, and his culminating statement got an audible response of, oh my, is this the best answer we can get? And what he said at the end is, yes, we are determined. He was under the stranglehold of determinism right from the beginning in a naturalistic framework. He said, yes, we are determined, but since we do not know what is determined, we may as well not be. That was his concluding statement. Yes, we are determined, but since we don't know what is determined, we may as well not be. What he's really saying is, since we don't know the answer to my the explanation for my conclusion, let us live as if it is not a legitimate conclusion. That's really what he was saying. So I say, when you're looking for a coherent worldview, look at it this way. What options would there have been for the great creator in the beginning of this? No world, at all versus this world. Okay? Number two, creating a world where there would be no such thing as good or evil, an amoral world. Number three, choosing a world where we would only choose good, where we'd be predetermined to choose good. There would be the total constraint. So we've got three options. Nothing versus what we now have. No such thing as good or evil. Or creating a constraint where we would only choose good and there were, we would never make the evil choice. Or number four, creating this kind of world where there would be the possibility of good and evil and we are given the option of the privilege of freedom and making the choice. Out of these four options, this option is the only universe and the only world in which love is possible. In the previous three, love is not possible at all. Love would not have been possible within, between the divine and human interaction. So I say this, sometimes these are mega questions and macro questions, and other times they are filtered down into micro questions and the fine-tuning of an individual life. I found the answer to this, first of all, from the negative. You take a naturalistic framework, you live with an incoherent world. I couldn't live with that. So how do I find coherence? In putting together the diversity in my own heart, which was put together by God. And that knowledge of a personal relationship with God would change not only what I did, but what I wanted to do in my personal life gave me hope, meaning, and a relationship. Let me give you just two quick illustrations because I think this is critical. I've had the opportunity of speaking at one of the most famous prisons in the world, Angola Prison in Louisiana. Abdu was with me, some of my colleagues with me. 6,000 plus prisoners there, 85% of whom are in life without parole. It was the bloodiest prison in America. Blood on the ceilings, blood on the carpets, blood on the walls. When a prisoner was checked in there, he was given a dagger or a knife with which to protect himself. And this warden comes in, this director comes in and says, I'm going to change this place. You allow me to do it my way. He put a Bible in every cell. He had chapel every day. He has a seminary that he's built in there. Within a matter of a year or two, it became the safest prison in America. Today, instead of a gang of thugs, they've got gangs of pastors going through that prison out there, and they're the prisoners themselves. We had lunch with them, and I said to the guy sitting opposite us, why don't you and get yours? He said, hey, man, I'm going nowhere. You may as well go and get yours, and then I'll join you. The guy who led in worship, a young man, I said to him, can I ask you a question? Because he led worship so beautifully. I said, can I ask you a question? Are you here for a life without parole? He said, yes, sir. I said, how do you feel? He said, Mr. Zacharias, if you'd known why I am here, you would never ask me that question. He said, but let me tell you something. Out there, I thought I was free, and the horrific things that I did destroyed people's lives and destroyed my own. Now, inside prison bars, having found Christ, I have never been freer in my life. This is the most free I have ever been. Pray for my family. They're outside and think they are free when they are really not. And he put his arm around me and prayed for me. And there were tears running down my face. We had lunch made by the prisoners. The warden sits there, eats the lunch that the prisoners have made. Boy, you call that faith? You better believe it. And he does it. Why? They have found meaning by an individual life being conquered. When you know Christ, when you have that relationship and your will is transformed to his will, you find out why you were made in the first place. And the crowd is just multiplied opportunity for individual conquest that God desires in every life out here tonight. I'll leave that with you.
Let's take a question from Twitter or text, because we are going to respond to those at some point. We do want to at least take one from there, because if you have sent something in, our promise is that we will respond to those. If not tonight, you will get something in the coming days. But let's take one. I know you all have been working. You have something on the screen from us, a Twitter or text question?
For those of us who can't read,
yeah. Go ahead.
Am I a bad person for doubting or questioning my faith? I think, you know, it's interesting. It's a good question. doubt, it'll become a dirty word. If we say, you know, you have to believe 100%, and if you have any questions or any doubts, then you're not really a true Christian or whatever these things might be. This is interesting because let me just answer this as shortly as I possibly can, but it's terribly, terribly important because I think people often fall into despair and their doubt creates further doubt. There's a difference between two things. There's a person who's a skeptic and there's a person who's a cynic. A skeptic is somebody who doesn't believe something until there's enough evidence. A cynic is somebody who won't believe it even when there is. Two different things. Now, if you're a skeptic, I'm skeptical of a lot of things. But if you're a skeptic and you come to wrestle with these issues, doubt can often drive us to a knowledge of the truth because it drives us to find out, is this really real or am I believing in a fantasy? And doubt can help us get there. John the Baptist, the story of John the Baptist, of course, who Jesus said there was no man greater and born among women than John the Baptist, comes when he's in prison and bad things had happened to him, and he comes and brings his people to Jesus and says, are you the one who's to come, or should we look for another? This is the same one who baptized Jesus and saw the dove and all these things, yet he has his doubts. And Jesus rewards his doubts, not with saying, go away, be gone, you're a doubter, get out of here. He says, go tell John the evidence. His doubt, his sincere doubt, was rewarded with evidence. So doubt can be something that leads us to faith, a stronger faith. But if it becomes cynicism, that becomes a problem.
Good. Excellent. Next question, please.
Hi there. I was raised by a mother who was a feminist and is a questioning Christian at the moment. And she finds that there's some contradictions somewhere in the Bible that states that male have to be dominant over women, and women have to be submissive. So, just from a Christian perspective, does God favor a gender specifically?
And you know why? What I think your mother has a fair question there. I don't think it's just in a vacuum or in any sense of just trying to be cavalier about it. Not just that. You think of the very nation that he chose through whom to reveal himself. He could have chosen Rome. He could have chosen Greece. He could have chosen Babylon. In fact, William T. Ewers, talking about it in a piece of poetry, said, how odd of God to choose the Jews. But then he went on to say, how odder still are those who reject whom God chose. God, I think, oftentimes in life, for the human life, chooses the weakest through whom to make his strength manifest. If you were to ask me what really makes this world, you know, let me dispel one idea here. You often hear a statement, men are more cerebral, women are more emotional. Nothing is farther from the truth. But I'll tell you what I have found. Both are equal cerebrally, but women are more consistent in willing to let the thought be connected to the emotion. Men like to hide from the emotional ramifications of the thought. So if I talked to my mother, she'd immediately connect the emotion with what she was thinking. With my father, he could draw circles around it because he'd run from the feeling. I've talked to husband and wife. We were on a vacation once, and they had both lost a son. And the woman was talking to my wife and said, it has put such a strain on our marriage because my husband doesn't even want to talk about it while I'm breaking up on the inside. They both had the same thoughts. One was running from it. The other was willing to find the greatest bridge between in life between the head and the heart. So even in theory, the whole idea is wrong. Secondly, some of the finest thinking in the world has been done by womankind. You see it. So this myth has to be dispensed with. It's purely an archaic thing. But to your question, is the Bible dishonorable like this in gender? We've just had Joe Vitale, who is on our team from Oxford. She has just defended her doctoral dissertation at Oxford on this very issue and this very subject, demonstrating how strongly the Bible speaks of the equality of the genders and what it is God has in mind and the complementariness of the two. So here is my question to you. If God were a discriminator against gender, the greatest truth on which the gospel hangs is the resurrection. If Christ be not raised from the dead, our faith is in vain. Why in heaven's name did he reveal himself to the women to go and tell the message? All of Easter hangs on the testimony of womankind with whom he trusted the entire gospel. When the woman with the alabaster ointment came to him and those were frowning about her, he looked at them and said, "Be quiet. Wherever the gospel is preached, there shall also this be told, what this woman has done to me in worship." He paid her the greatest compliment that the gospel would be carried to the ends of the earth, and this story of this woman's faith will also be told. He goes to Samaria, and he sees a woman at the well with 5 broken, shattered marriages. She was ethnically barred from the society, as it were, maritally broken and shattered 5 times. He made her the first evangelist to the Samaritan world. Imagine what an incredibly gracious God to remind us that none of us is superior to the other. We only have the same privilege of taking our distinctives and complementary strengths and carrying the message to the world. I can tell you this, I would never be here today if it weren't for the strength of my mother. And when my younger brother was 6 or 7 years old, he was dying with double pneumonia and typhoid. My dad had given up. Our family had given up. We were living in Delhi. And the doctor came and told us, my younger brother Ramesh, who's today the chairman of the Department of Pain Management at McMaster University in Canada. He was 6 or 7, dying. I remember seeing him as a bag of bones for the last time. I'm 6 years older than him. And I walked away from there bidding him goodbye. He was unconscious. My mother refused to leave. She refused to leave. She sat by his bedside, and we were all worn to the bone, including my dad. And so 4 of us kids packed up, taken back home, and all of us lying in bed saying, "We've just lost our youngest." My mother sat by his bedside. Whatever she was doing, I don't know, and in sheer exhaustion, for days she hadn't slept, and just by his bedside crying out to God to rescue her son. Somewhere in the early hours of the morning, he began to move and began to, he was very much alive, but just quite worn out and broken. And that need of life was coming back to him. And the next day, when we all were told to come back to the hospital, his eyes were open and his whole life given fresh strength. There was only 1 out of the 6 of us there who had the strength to sit by that bedside and watch what loomed as a tragedy, and watch the triumph to turn into victory. Anybody who thinks that's weak and lesser doesn't understand reality. God is the God of humankind. And the last thing Jesus said on the cross for the redemption of mankind was, "Look at a young man and tell him not to forget his mother, to make sure she was also taken care of because a sword was piercing through her heart." That is our Lord, who treats all of us with intrinsic worth and reflective splendor. And I thank God for the beauty he has created in this complementariness.
Thank you.
Let's do this. We're still going to have some time to answer questions in the back. We've got kind of a special thing. I want to make sure we cover at the end. So let's do this. Let's do one final question. Dr. Zacharias, I believe, wants to have some final words here, and then let's take a final question on this.
Hi. I was wondering, I've grown up in steeped in church traditions. I've grown up, I went to a religious school. I still go to a religious school. And I feel that perhaps indirectly, I've been taught that the most important thing about Jesus is his death. And I was wondering how true that is.
Well, boy, without his death, there is no gospel. Without his resurrection, the death doesn't mean anything. I once gave a talk, great question, by the way. I once gave a talk at a business. I sort of was talking about Easter at Diversity Day. They'd never had a thing about Easter done at this particular business. And I made this statement, and I think it's true, that Christmas without Easter is meaningless. Easter without Christmas is not possible. So you see the birth and the death and the resurrection all wrapped up into the story. The story is a beginning, middle, and end. But when Jesus was asked, why have you come? He says, for this reason I have come. He's come to give his life as a ransom for many. That's the reason. Now that ransom is his death as a payment for sin, because what the gospel tells you and tells me is this. And by the way, if I can just have a short aside here, I love Jesus for a lot of reasons. One of those reasons is he's not a salesperson who tells you what you want to hear. He tells you what you need to hear. It's a very terrible sales pitch to say, you're evil, come follow me. What kind of a poster is that? But people do it anyway. He tells you what you need to hear, not what you want to hear, in distinction to every other worldview, by the way, which tells you that you can do it yourself. You're the one who can make it on your own. And I think if the 24-hour news is one of the worst inventions of the past 20, 30 years. I got a clap over here on that one. One thing it does provide us, though, is ample evidence that man is in need of a savior who's not himself. We need someone who's not us to save us from ourselves because of our innate innate evil and our sin. Jesus told us that 2,000 years ago. So we need someone who can redeem us, who can pay the penalty that we deserve. Jesus says, I'm that guy. Now, what's interesting is, if he died and stayed dead, then how would you know he's right? He could be dead and, well, maybe he was right, maybe he was wrong, who knows? He's like everybody else, so maybe he was wrong. But he didn't stay dead. His death is the payment. When he says on that cross, tetelestai, when he says that in the Greek, it actually means it is finished, it is accomplished. It's a financial term, paid in full. It's like a stamp on a document. The debt is paid. That is done for us. But you can know that he was right, that he took away the sins of the world through that death because of his resurrection. If he died and stayed dead, no way to know. But he didn't die and stay dead. He showed his conquering over that death, his conquering over the last enemy, through the physical and, I believe, truly historical resurrection from the dead. So the death without the resurrection doesn't really show you anything, but the resurrection shows that the death meant something. In fact, let me just put it this way plainly, it meant everything. Thank you.
Some years ago, I had the privilege of speaking at the United Nations, and they had asked me to speak on a search for absolutes in a relativistic world. It's a tough subject, especially in the early hours of the morning. And you're given about 18 minutes. And what I did in my talk is talked about four absolutes that we really look for: evil, justice, love, and forgiveness. I said we all have the desire to call some nation an evil nation. You brand some nations evil nations. But you all also talk about justice. You want just societies. You all love your families and you miss your families. And then some of you are going to blow it ethically, and you need to be forgiven. Evil, justice, love, and forgiveness. So I said to them, where in the world did all of these converge at one point in history? There was pin drop silence. I said they converged on a hill called Calvary. And as that meeting was over and I presented to them the message of Calvary, they were lined up, the ambassadors. And one of them came to me, shook my hand, and he said, Dr. Zacharias, he said, I come from an atheistic nation. And I don't want to be here. My president asked me to come here. I hate being here. I miss being here. But I want to say to you, today I have found out why I came here. I came here to find God. I came here to find God. Recently, I was in a Middle Eastern nation where the Minister of Finance came and asked if he could talk to me personally. Some of my colleagues know which one I'm talking about. He doesn't want to be there. So much violence. He sent his family out. And he said, I'm only here because of my faith and the sacrifice that Christ made for me, that I want to do my part in life. To take one aspect of the gospel and make it the most important aspect is actually that which God had joined together, let no one put asunder. It is the birth, life, death, and resurrection. They are all put together. His death was spoken of, prophesied, and so was his resurrection. Even Paul struggled with that I may know him, the power of his resurrection, and the fellowship of his suffering being made conformable unto his death. One thing the death of cross that Christ does is answer for me the question of evil and pain and suffering, that no other worldview offers. My colleague Vince Vitale and I wrote the book, Why Suffering? And in that I made the comment that God does not conquer in spite of the dark mystery of evil. He conquers through it. He conquers through it. So the cross is central, but it is not in isolation, because you and I do not need a guru. We need a savior to offer and heal that which is central to your life and mine. And the Cross of Christ by John Stott is one of the most powerful books I have ever read. If you haven't read that book by John R.W. Stott, it's an all-time classic. Please take it and read it. But it fits into the grand design of God's total plan. Thank you for asking that. And now I come to this closing. Many times, as the years have gone by, and I've been in this now for 4 decades, I ask myself the question, why am I doing this? What's in it for me? Your organizers will tell you, money is not even mentioned in this when we come. I frankly don't know who's paying for what in this. We just show up. We're here. And we cover 15 to 20 countries a year. Deep in my heart, I am persuaded that outside of Jesus Christ, there is no other answer to the haunting questions of your life and mine. I say that truthfully. As book after book has been written, I have no other answers. If there were, I would give them to you. And so whether you're speaking at the Center for Geopolitical Strategy in Moscow or the UN or a university or sitting next to somebody in a plane, the only answer I have seen is in the person of Jesus Christ on the 4 questions of life, of origin, meaning, morality, and destiny. And especially to you students, may I say this, you have a rare privilege. You have a very rare privilege. I didn't have the mind that you all do, frankly, and I'm not putting this up, but I would never have made it into a university like this. I lived for cricket. I wanted to play cricket. I was a sports person. I wanted to play cricket for India. That was my goal. I neglected my studies, never worked hard, ended up with shame on a bed of suicide. In about 2 weeks from now, I'm speaking at St. Stephen's College at the University of Delhi, probably the premier institution in the whole country of that specific nature. Anybody here from India will tell you St. Stephen's College, Delhi. Most of India's students would never even get in. And yet the principal has asked me if I would come there and present a defense of the Christian faith. God has a sense of humor. I would never have made it as a student. And now they're asking me to come and speak to them. This is how God does it. Because the coherence of the Judeo-Christian worldview deals with where you are. And you have 2 options to go with. And I'll close with this and give you what I think would be a marvelous response on your part. Your tensions are great. Your allurements are great. Your physicality is a strength, but also makes you vulnerable. You are possibly oftentimes at the mercy of an academic who wants to knock God out of you. This happens again and again and again. I hear it so often. I will tell you this. You reject God, and your worldview will become systemically incoherent. You follow the truth where it leads, and in the person of Christ, you will find personal meaning and the meaning that God can help you carry it to the rest of the world. Konrad Adenauer, after the Second World War, was alone with Billy Graham. Billy Graham is not very formally educated, and he will tell you that. With a minimal education, God's anointed him. Konrad Adenauer looked at Billy Graham. Billy Graham told this to us around a gathering of lunch. And he looked at me and he said, Mr. Graham, do you believe Jesus Christ really rose from the dead? And Graham said, Mr. Adenauer, if I didn't believe that, I would have no message left to preach to the world. He said, Konrad Adenauer walked out towards the window, looked out of that window and turned around. He said, looking at the ruins of his city, he said, Mr. Graham, outside of the resurrection of Jesus Christ, I know of no other hope for mankind. Outside of the resurrection of Jesus Christ, I know of no other hope for mankind. Several years ago, when I was a young man just starting my ministry living in Toronto, I was driving on the 401. It was a cold night, snowy night. I was driving in my little Volkswagen Red Bug, and I saw a guy on the side of the road thumbing for a ride on a highway. I said, somebody's going to run over him. I pulled up on the side quite late at night, about 10:30. I opened the door. I said, are you okay? He said, can you take me home, sir? I said, where do you live? And he told me it was not near my home, but I was fearful for him. and fearful for myself. He's a total stranger. I said, come on in. So before he even said anything, I said, please give me your name. He said, my name is Lorne, Lorne Lusthouse. I said, as we are driving, talk to me about who you are, and then I will tell you what I do. And as we were driving, he said to me, tonight's been another night. Same thing, liquor, fun, everything. He said, Ravi, I'm a messed up young guy. I'm totally messed up. He was stopping, pausing, thinking, collecting his thoughts. When I dropped him off at his home, I took his hand. I said, Lorne, I'm leaving out of town early tomorrow morning. Will you please see me when I come back next week? Here is my phone number and my address. I want to see you. I want to meet with you. He said, okay. And he took my phone number and address. When I came back, there was a letter waiting for me from Lorne Lusthouse. But when I contacted, I found out that week he had burned himself to death as well. And in my letter was this poem. I want you to think about it. Lost in a world of darkness, without a guiding light, seeking a friend to help my struggling, failing plight. So all of you good people just go on passing by, leaving me with nothing but this lonely will to die. For somewhere in this lonely world of sorrow and of woe, there's a place for me to hide, but where, I do not know. For no matter where I go, I never will escape the devil's reaching, clutching hand or the drink of fermented grape. So out of my grief and anguish, perhaps some wandering boy will see and build his own life in this world, strong and good and free. But he was gone. What a genius to be able to put those thoughts together. What if the same young man had turned that genius to the glory of God as a poet? You look at a fork in the road, and I just say to you, you don't have to take our word for it. Get the Gospel of John and say a prayer. Jesus, if you're really who you claim to be, speak to my heart and change my heart. If you are truly the Son of God, you mean that sincerely, and I'm hopeful that he will answer your prayer. And when you enter that relationship, you will become an ambassador for him as well. What an honor for me to be here at your great university and see a turnout like this. We're not worthy of a turnout of this nature, but thank you for hosting us. And if even one of you gives your life to Jesus Christ or begins your journey in that direction, we would consider worth it for having come here. Turn your heart towards the home for which God has made you and build your own life strong and good and free. God bless you and thank you.